Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You are listening to Mist Apex Podcast. We live F1. And welcome to Tech Time with Summer's F1. I am your host, Matt Trumpet, and we have none other than that story denizen of the Tech Deep, Matthew Summerfield, a.k.a. Summer's F1 technical editor at motorsport.com, who has surfaced long enough to spout some F1 wisdom our way. But before we get started, I have to remind you that we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. And that brings me to Summers. It is so good to see you again because it has been a minute.
It sure has, but we've got four races already under our belt this season, so we have got plenty to talk about.
And it's kind of amazing to me that four races in and only now, just now in Japan, have we seen the cars on something that I'd consider to be an actual racetrack.
Yeah, and obviously that will give us a completely different read over what we've seen already in the three races prior to that. So always handy data to take into a show like this.
Indeed. But I haven't told you the best news.
What's that?
Best news is that Spanners is on holiday and he's given us the keys to the castle and we can now run amok.
Well, you know that means tire talk.
Indeed. So let's start with a team that has been doing a lot better with their tires, and that's going to be Ferrari. Now, one of the things that struck me about this is that Ferrari has lately been very un-Ferrari. They've been doing a good job on strategy. They had a pit stop in Japan that saw them actually win a place for Leclerc over McLaren's pit stop with Norris. And they have brought a car that if anyone's going to be a contender and not a pretender, it's going to be the Ferrari. So tell me right now, how are they doing and how have they solved in particular their tire degradation issues, which really seemed to plague them all of last season?
Yeah, I mean, I think for Ferrari, you have to also look back at last season in terms of the back end of the season, because you've got the issue of the tire degradation, which they resolved almost at the back end of last season, and they've brought that across into this year's design. So I think predominantly it was a rear tyre issue that they were struggling with, and I think that they've enabled themselves to deal with that via changing some of the rear brake duct arrangements. If people aren't aware with how that particular side of things work, so there's some heat transference that happens between the rear brakes, the rear brake duct, the wheel rim, and then the bulk temperature of the tire, and obviously that has a cyclical nature in terms of how you have thermal heating inside the tyre itself, how that contributes to heating the compound, and then obviously how that has an impact over the course of a lap or indeed a stint. So if you can control those things differently by means of a redesign in certain parameters of the brake duct, then obviously you can influence the tyre temperature slightly differently as well. So perhaps some of that is to do with that. And obviously we have noticed that they've made some alterations to the way that they deal with their rear suspension as well. So in that respect, I feel like Ferrari do have more of a handle on the tyre issue than they have in the past. And it certainly, as you say, helped them to be better in terms of race strategy and being able to perhaps race those around them where they haven't been able to because of the tyre issues in the past.
Okay, so one thing that I think you pointed out in one of your articles was that they had started to take advantage of a space that you hadn't seen anyone yet building in. So how important is that area sort of in between the rear wing and the diffuser for making the entire ground effect concept work well?
Okay, so I think what teams sort of learned fairly early on into this regulation cycle is that the beam wing is obviously very important in terms of adjusting both drag and downforce levels from circuit to circuit. Red Bull being the primary factor here because they went through a stage of using a smaller suite of rear wings, but having the ability to use what they, or should I say, optimize what they need at each particular circuit by running a different beam wing configuration. Now, for Ferrari, they've done something very interesting over the course of the four first races this season, in as much as that they've used the same rear wing every single race. All they've done is modify which beam wing layout they use, whether it be a biplane, a full-blown two-tier setup, or a single element, or indeed the extra pylon winglets that they added in Australia. So that is how Ferrari have tuned their car for the certain circuit specifics this season, rather than switching rear wing solutions, which is what we would normally see teams do. Now, that's not to say that they didn't have rear wings available to them within their suite, because they did at Saudi Arabia. They had a low downforce rear wing available to them, according to the car presentation document, but we never saw it. And similarly in Suzuka, they had a higher downforce rear wing that we never saw. But as I've mentioned, that car presentation document, it did say that those were 2023 items carried across. So I do think that we'll probably see something a little bit different once we start to see Ferrari make some of their bigger updates as we enter the European season. But as it goes so far, we've seen them do most of their adaptation for downforce and drag via the beam wing rather than the rear wing itself.
Okay, so I just want to follow up for a second here and ask, with regards to that, it's not necessarily total downforce we're talking about when you change the configuration of the wings. We're talking about how efficient all of those, I think the aerodynamicists call them structures, the air coming over the top of the rear wing, coming through the middle, and then coming underneath the floor, all have to sort of talk to each other at the rear end of the car. So some of that is going to be efficiency. But is some of that also to help balance where the pressure is on the car to make it turn the way you want it to turn, to keep the tires from sliding as much? So in other words, I know there's like a mechanical balance to the car, a center of gravity, but I also know that there's sort of a pressure balance of the car where the center of the pressure is of all the aerodynamics on the car. Are these rear wings changing both of those, or is it really just mostly what's happening at the back where you're seeing this impact?
Yeah, I mean, we're not really seeing them having to trim the front wing, let's say, because if we think about the fact that they've not changed the rear wing, that more or less tallies with the front wing. In the past, let's say under the older regulations, we would have seen a lot of teams use a trimmed front wing with a lower downforce rear wing. But because we've now got the beam wing available again, which we didn't have in the previous set of regulations, suddenly the teams have got a means in order to balance the car better, as you mentioned, from a COP point of view, but predominantly just in terms of balance and in terms of efficiency. So, you know, downforce versus drag. So I feel like Ferrari have perhaps been given a lesson looking back at the way in which the Red Bull have been doing things since the start of this regulation set, but they're not the only ones that have done it that way. Other teams have also done it. But it is interesting that they've not used a different rear wing over the course of four very different races in terms of downforce levels, because historically, I don't believe we've ever seen that really before. More or less, people will have a rear wing available as well as a different beam wing setting. So it's quite an interesting situation we've seen unfolded there from Ferrari.
So am I then taking it that what Ferrari is figuring out is what Red Bull seems to have understood from the off with these regulations, is that being predictable is worth a lot more lap time than some maximum peak downforce that the drivers can't actually handle?
Yeah, I mean, there will be some of that to it in terms of that, you know, you want a more benign car, let's say, but it's a trade-off in every situation at the end of the day. You know, you're not going to take a barn door rear wing to Monza and expect it to perform like a low downforce rear wing would, but there would be gains, obviously, in different parts of that circuit. So it's always a trade-off between high downforce, low downforce, medium downforce. But what I think that teams like Ferrari are currently doing is they are looking for stability from the front and rear wing and using the beam wing as that trade-off to be able to tune it for the circuit that they're currently going to.
Well, this is very encouraging then. So there's no real issue at this point with thinking that if they keep it up, they might actually be able to chase Red Bull a little more tightly than they have been. I mean, after all, they've already won one race this season, and it took them a lot longer last season.
Yeah, but did Max Verstappen retire from a race that they obviously won? Yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, Ferrari have made progress compared to where they have been in the past. However, the advantage that Red Bull hold is still larger than you would like to see. And I feel like Ferrari will still continue to catch up, especially when we see a more refined version of some of the concepts that they've bought into this season when they arrive with updates around the European season. We're expecting them to refine aspects of the car that have changed dramatically from where they were at the start of last season, for argument's sake, and have transitioned towards a different type of side pod, for argument's sake. So I still feel like they've got a huge amount of margin to gain, but will it be enough to close that gap to Red Bull? Well, I think, unfortunately, we're in a situation where they have got a significant head start based upon the fact that they've moved away from a concept that most people are now chasing towards.
Okay, so spoil all my fun, but I will point out in my defense that just last week someone won a $1 billion lottery and they were the only one who won it. So it can't be that impossible, right?
No, well, the odds are stacked in your favor forever or something along those lines.
Okay, well, I do want to follow up a little bit more because you mentioned side pods, and I know that's a very popular topic these days. So I want to explore the fact that Ferrari did change from sort of their washtub tortellini side pod to one that is sort of more along lines of what Red Bull has been putting out and what Mercedes has switched to. And is that sort of a convergence? I mean, not in terms of overall shape and look, because clearly they look different, but in terms of what they're asking the air going over the top of that side pod to do when it gets to the back of the car.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you look at most of the grid now, they have converged on what we would consider to be a downwash ramp style solution. So in other words, you start at a higher point at the start of the bodywork, i.e. the leading edge of the side pod, and then it ramps down towards the floor at the rear of the car. There's a huge variation up and down the grid about how they approach what the rest of the bodywork does and how that influences both the wake generated by the front tire and also the airflow that's moving around the undercut, the floor itself, into the coke bottle region, engine cover. There's so much going on that obviously every car is very different about how that particular concept is approached, but they have all moved very similarly towards an overall design concept, which we call the downwash ramp.
Okay, and if I'm thinking about it, when we talk about Ferrari, before we move on, because as much as I'd like to talk about them and play them up as potentially being competitors, and I do feel like the reason I keep devolving to this, and here maybe you can tell me I'm right or wrong, but the reason I keep coming back to this is because of all the teams who showed up, it seems like only they and Red Bull have sort of met their expectations for coming into this season. And so the question is, as you say, will the Ferrari updates bring them closer, cover more ground, kind of like McLaren did last season? Or is it just going to sort of be this tit for tat where they just answer each other's developments and the basic distance between them doesn't change?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the voyage into the unknown, isn't it? Especially when you're trying to build on a concept that you've already developed over the course of the back end of last season into this and developed it further this season. The second batch of developments for this season will probably be another evolution of that particular design set, whereas what Ferrari are currently utilising is probably a season ago's worth of Red Bull's design infrastructure, and they've moved on considerably since then. However, how much yield do they have left? How much development can Red Bull continue to make before they hit the ceiling again? Because they obviously felt that they'd hit a ceiling with their particular design, i.e. what everybody else has sort of moved towards this season, and then moved on to something else, which I'm sure we'll cover in a moment. But, you know, there has to be a limit at some point behind a specific design direction before you then decide, hang on, I need to move on to something else. Now, will Ferrari be able to find more than Red Bull did under the old design route, or will they have to make a switch to something more like Red Bull and cede that ground that they'd already gained in order to try to find more performance from what Red Bull are now doing? And that's the cat and mouse scenario that you find in the development between both teams and each season, and how they approach when to make the switch because they can't find any more performance.
Yeah, so essentially what happens, I'm guessing, is that your designers start bringing you developments worth hundreds instead of tens, and you start thinking to yourself, okay, maybe there's some other larger limiting factor that we're going to have to go back to the drawing board and do a bigger rethink in order to continue making gains at the pace you really need to make those gains if you want to win Formula One races.
Exactly that. It's all the smaller numbers that add up to make a bigger number at the end of the day. So there's a chain of events, essentially, and you're looking for the bigger numbers along the way. But one bigger number in one particular area might lead to smaller numbers somewhere else down the chain. And so you then have to sort of circle back to that original design and rethink the situation. And I think that's where Red Bull got to at the back end of last season with their design. And that's why we're seeing them run something completely different for 2024.
And I will admit, it's slightly annoying to me because I had hopes because they were making, you know, and they announced they were making a bigger change. We're sort of running out of room here. And I did have that hope that they might have some of the same, should we be super nice and call them teething problems that certain teams had when they first came into this regulation set. But it seems to have gone very, very seamlessly for them. Unfortunately, for me at least, just being a fan of, you know, having two teams at the front fighting each other.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously is galling that you know, we're in a situation where there's a big gap, a big void between one team to the next, but that's Formula One for you. It's an engineering challenge as much as it is a sporting challenge, and you have to appreciate the lengths that Red Bull have gone to in order to get where they are right now, and hopefully the other teams will be able to make the difference up in between.
Yeah, well, I mean, I will point out that I think looking at Sainz's last stint in Japan, for example, he was basically on pace with the probably a little bit coasting Red Bulls. But I do see encouraging signs that here or there, teams are getting a little bit closer. And I am really focused on Ferrari a bit because they're the only ones who've put up anything that remotely looks like a challenge. But we're talking about Red Bull, and so we're going to have to talk about this. I am so intrigued by the fact that every team, or most every team, now has a big underbite, by which I mean sort of that lateral leading edge at the front of the side pod, versus Red Bull, who had had that and made it bigger and bigger, and now suddenly they've completely inverted it and gone to what we could easily call an overbite to help people visualize what it looks like. And I'm going to ask, why? Why would they do that? And did the other teams miss a trick by not trying that out first? Or is it just simply that's where they got to with their design, do you think?
Yeah, I think this just comes down to natural iteration. As I mentioned earlier, you get to a certain point whereby there's no low-hanging fruit left available to steal from the tree. And I think because of the way that Red Bull developed last season, they had the initial design of their underbite, and then they had two upgrades throughout the course of the season, one at Baku, and I think Hungary off the top of my head, but probably maybe not Hungary, I can't quite remember anyway, but they had two iterational versions post the first version of that particular design, whereby they increased the height of the underbite in order that the inlet itself became shallower, and that increased the size of the undercut bodywork. And so you then are trading off between cooling and aerodynamics, and you're trying to find a fine line between the two. And I think where Red Bull got to is they realised that, hang on a minute, we're at the point now whereby we can't make the inlet any smaller, but we still want more performance from the undercut. So how do we make the difference up? Well, they do what they did, and you end up with a horizontal and a vertical slit down the side of the chassis, and a larger undercut with an overbite, and then you have supplementary cooling via the intake that's between the rear leg of the halo and the cockpit channel. So I think you also have to remember here that Red Bull haven't just done this from a bodywork perspective in order to make aerodynamic gains. They've also made a huge amount of changes to the infrastructure of the side pods within. So they now have V-shaped radiators and coolers in the way in which they are relaxed with inside the side pods in order that they can feed them differently. And so they've looked at this from multiple angles. It's not just a one-dimensional change. They've not just gone, oh, yeah, we need to change the inlet position and get more undercut. They've actually had to change things internally in order to make these changes work. And in theory, they've also made some interesting directional changes and design changes because they've looked at other people's designs. So the vertical inlet alongside the chassis is very much something that we've seen from Ferrari last season and again this season, and Red Bull have figured a way to adopt that. And they've also taken the gully system alongside the engine cover from Mercedes from last season, who have actually not used it this season. But they're taking ideas from others and they're figuring out how to make them work with their own design structure and improve upon them. And that is the great thing about Red Bull's iterational design process, in that they are not too ashamed to move on to something else, learn from others and make it better.
Right. So if I'm stealing from you, it's a tribute. Exactly. I love it. Now, I do want to ask, because you said, you know, they were talking about making it smaller, but I've noticed already this season that the lateral inlet on the side pod for the Red Bull has shrunk dramatically to the point where it looks like something I'd mail a letter through and not something appropriate for cooling an F1 power unit in the middle of a race. So is it the case that if you add up all those other openings that you mentioned, you still get a huge surface area like we used to see, just the big square boxy ones, the inlets for the side pods for the cooling? Or have they also gotten more efficient with how they're cooling that power unit?
again, I think it's a multi-stage situation. So yes, the inlets are smaller. That was an update that they brought to Suzuka. So the horizontal inlet that you mentioned, or the shark mouth, as many people have taken to calling it, on the underside of the undercut of the side pod, has actually become shallower than it was before. However, it's also come with a new inlet or intake alongside the rear leg of the halo on the outside of the bodywork. So suddenly we've got an extra inlet there, which looks very reminiscent of the Benetton B188, if you're not familiar with the inlet that I'm talking about. But essentially, I think what we are also thinking here is that whilst the radiators, coolers, etc., all the ancillaries inside the RB20 have been moved around for this season compared to where they were last season, they've also perhaps been optimised in how they actually operate compared to how they have in the past, which obviously then allows you to have smaller openings anyway. But on top of that, I think some of these inlets are not really focused on cooling per se. They're focused on creating a better flow structure through the side pods so that the cooling works more efficiently. So it's sort of a compound effect. Yes, the smaller openings, which means you're more efficient from that side of things, but also you're using openings to improve the aerodynamics of the car as in general, such as the chassis one down the side of the side pod is about boundary layer control alongside the chassis. You know, it's not just about cooling, it's about also having fringe benefits from an aerodynamics point of view for other areas of the car. So some very, very interesting solutions, but as I say, not all really built in-house by Red Bull, but adapted by them to better suit the layout that they've gone for this season.
Okay, and I'm now absolutely going to pretend I know exactly what a boundary layer is, and I could easily calculate one if I had to. But just in case I wasn't sure, could you give us a brief description of what's going on there and why that inlet might be helpful in terms of the overall aerodynamics in that area of the car?
Okay, so basically, as the air flows along a surface, it will become the what we call the boundary layer will become thicker as it reaches a slower speed along that surface, and so you get what's called a boundary layer build-up, whereby it starts to detach away from the surface itself. If you impede that by means of a vortex generator, a winglet, to induce a new more aggressive style of aerodynamic flow along that area, then you obviously improve the flow structure both locally and downstream. Now, if you want to look at the way that the Red Bull, the Ferrari, and indeed perhaps you could almost argue that Alpine and Mercedes with their P-shaped inlets are doing very similar, is that they are using that airflow alongside the chassis in a different way than what we've seen in the past in order to help deal with the inefficiencies of the aerodynamic flow structures that are built up alongside the chassis, the issues of tyre wake that is shed from the front tyre. You have to remember there's a lot of turbulent mess happening in and around that region that is no longer able to be controlled by surfaces like barge boards or airflow conditioners because you just can't have them in this particular regulation set. And so teams have had to find ways in order to improve those areas of the car by different means. And that's why we're seeing these sort of solutions appear on the car.
It's amazing to me. It's been so long since we talked about barge boards and things that weren't barge boards that I was sitting there going, what is it called again? No, it's not a sideboard. Don't say that. Don't say that. No, don't say that. But this is an outgrowth of just having certain aerodynamic toys taken away. They're finding novel solutions for the problem. That will always exist in any open wheel car.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a reinterpretation. Formula One has a very good way of using solutions that we've had in the past, and suddenly they don't become valuable anymore. So they're pushed to one side. And then as a regulation set reappears or reemerges or something works differently because of that new regulation set, they'll pick it back up and start to use it again. So when I was talking about the V-shaped radiators inside the side pods of the Red Bull, it's not the first time we've seen those. Ferrari, Haas have used them in the past. And if you go back to the V10 era, Sauber used them. So, you know, it's not new. It's just repurposed to better use them for this particular moment in Formula One. And you're using those historical principles right now and using them to your maximum.
All right. So before we leave Red Bull, who I think it's very clear they are doing a better job than anyone else, and hats off to their engineering and aerodynamics because they have been on it from the start of these regulations. How is it that they're able to stay so far ahead? I mean, they had the penalty. They get the least amount of testing time. Where do you know where they're finding some of these loopholes that they must be finding in order to continue this rate of development relative to the other teams?
Well, I would say, first of all, they've always seemed a step ahead of everybody else when it comes to the underfloor. Just have a generally better understanding of how to utilize the volume available within the underfloor itself, and then also how that interacts with the upper surfaces and the edge wing and everything, the diffuser, everything that is ride height sensitive, that is ground facing, Red Bull just seem to have a better understanding of than many of the other teams. On top of that, if you look at the edge wing, for argument's sake, at Suzuka, they bought a new version for that particular race. And let's not beat about the bush, most of the teams on the grid are using a very similar edge wing design now to Red Bull that they introduced at the middle of last season and have developed upon since. And their new version has something that we haven't seen from anybody else before as well, a little upstand at the rear of the edge wing, which will undoubtedly shed a vortex that is going to help with controlling the rear tyre squirt. So they're still iterating and making performance from those elements. But on top of that, I think it's also crucial to remember that whilst they were penalised from a standings point of view last season, they also had the cost cap infraction. So that meant that they had less wind tunnel and CFD than anybody else on the grid by a considerable margin, yet they were still able to find performance. And I think it was important to remember that I think they looked laterally at how they were affected by those rules and looked at areas of the car that they could continue to maximise performance from without being penalised by the wind tunnel and CFD restrictions, which comes down to how they've improved the efficiency of their radiators and internal coolers, because that is an unlimited aspect of testing both CFD and wind tunnel. And if you then use the CFD and wind tunnel that you have at your disposal, which isn't limited, then you can work the two against one another. And that's where we've seen Red Bull make the biggest strides. Obviously, it's very visible because that's one area of the car that we get to see a lot. But I think there's both that and the underfloor that I've already mentioned, where they tend to seem to have a better handle on this regulation set than anybody else.
Okay. And we're going to talk about, in a minute, cooling in a less happy way, because I think that even though I don't want to talk about bad things or unhappy things or expectations not met, it's hard for me to ignore what's happening at Mercedes relative to what's going on at Red Bull. And I bring this up because Red Bull is supposedly, you know, they were supposedly doing zero pods at the beginning of the year. And we've certainly seen some of the design featured, you mentioned the gullies, that Red Bull have borrowed from them, they themselves have dropped. But when it comes to the actual car they've brought, am I wrong in thinking that maybe Mercedes doesn't understand this iteration of their car any better than they did the zero pods iteration?
Yeah, well, fundamentally, you're starting from zero again, aren't you? You know, that's the way to think about it. At the end of the day, the zero pod was version one. They had version two of that that they thought that they could make work, which was, you know, different in some respects. They then made the switch to more of a downwashing, high-waisted side pod solution in the back end of last season from Monaco onwards. And this year is more of an iteration of that. So it's still... I would still say that they're hanging out there on their own in some respects. You know, they've not fully committed to some of the solutions that we've seen elsewhere. And you have to guard against that sometimes anyway, because if you just copy everybody's homework, well, you're never going to be better than them, or at least, you know, you're not going to win every single time. And so I can understand why they might want to stretch out and have some of their own design aspects to the car. But as you mentioned, they're sort of starting from zero again, because for the fundamentals of how they operated their previous cars are very different to how they're operating this car. And it seems that they still don't understand some of the intricacies of the car and how to operate it under certain conditions, because they don't have the experience of that, whereas other teams like Ferrari and Red Bull have built upon what was already a decent set of building blocks to start with, and so they have, you know, the data at their disposal to work outwards from there.
Right. Well, one of the concerns that I have, I don't know if you saw this quote from Toto Wolff about the 70 points of downforce or not. It was I came across it in the Italian press, but I'm wondering, how is it that you can measure having that downforce but still be unable to use it? And then the larger question, which concerns me most of all, and you may not have an answer to, which is, it seems like this whole mess started for them when they designed a car and it had unexpected properties that none of their testing and simulation predicted. And I'm just wondering, is this still kind of an unsolved problem in their background, or are they fundamentally in a different space than they were the previous 2 years in terms of that?
I think they are in a different space to where they were in the previous two seasons. I think 2022, like a lot of the other teams, they had really found a problem between the correlation of their tools that they use in the factory, i.e. CFD and wind tunnel, and what was actually happening in the real world. And that was primarily driven by factors revolving around ride height, and obviously porpoising was the main talking point when we first saw the cars back in 2022. But we have to remember that Red Bull never really had those issues. Porpoising was never really an issue for them. Yes, they had it from time to time, but it was very minimal. And so it's a problem that should have been understood, and it did become understood by everybody else. And obviously, this car in its own right doesn't have those problems, but it still has inherited some of the functionality of the previous chassis, because at the end of the day, it's an evolutionary design. They haven't completely turned off the development programs on all of the surfaces of the car that they've had in the past. So they're still having similar issues. And as you mentioned, CFD and wind tunnel, I believe that they're still having some of the issues that they had in the first year, whereby they don't thoroughly understand why what they're seeing in simulation isn't appearing at the track. And it's not happening all the time either. That is the big problem. As you mentioned, the 70 points of downforce, well, we've talked earlier about having a more benign or vanilla car, and this car is more of that, but it appears that it still isn't far enough along that train in order to extract the performance that they're looking for.
Okay, so if I'm Mercedes, if I'm a Mercedes fan, am I taking any heart from the fact that in general, the tracks where we've been have not been the kind of tracks that normally favor them, and that maybe once we get to different tracks, we'll see some improved performance? But also, if I'm a fan, am I getting increasingly concerned about their ability to manage tire temperatures again, something that was a problem for them in the way, way back long ago, and they eventually got on top of. But now it seems like, is this a problem that's sort of reappearing?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously something that's exacerbated by the issues that they are struggling with anyway, from a setup point of view. So obviously you're going to lean on certain aspects of the setup, and it appears that that then has an issue in terms of the tire temperatures, degradation, stint lengths, everything else that you can think of. And yeah, I mean, obviously they need to find some answers to the problems, which they have in the past, and I'm quite sure they have the ability to do so again. But it's how far that they have fallen behind the lead pack that is more problematic, because in order to go three steps back, they're going to lose even more performance and a little bit of face along the way, perhaps. So that's where being diligent in how they approach their testing program prior to a race weekend is going to be critical in order to prepare themselves for the situation that's unfolding in terms of needing to find more performance, but inherently having to maybe take a few steps back first.
Okay. And last thing I want to bring up before we move on to slightly brighter pastures and greener skies is, that was a joke, is they did entirely redesign their rear suspension. Are we seeing some of that play out? Because they had not run, they switched from the pull rod to the push rod, yeah? They hadn't run that in, I don't know, ever, maybe? So is a lack of like historical understanding of this maybe playing into part of the problems they're having now? I guess that's the question I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, I mean, we could almost see it as a sort of hangover from the factor of, for a long time, them having different tools at their disposal from a suspension point of view as well, when you talk about Frick, etc. But I think in terms of having the suspension arrangement at the rear of the car that they have now, historically, I think you'd probably have to go back to 2010, which was the first year of Mercedes GP, for the last time that they ran that arrangement. Certainly it was that way for the Braun GP car. But I'm pretty certain they took it on into 2010, and then they made the switch with the double diffuser / exhaust blown diffuser in 2011 to the layout that they've just abandoned. So a long time, obviously, as you say, running a very specific type of suspension arrangement, but it shouldn't be anything that causes them dramatic issues. It's just something to rethink and re-engineer. And obviously, they're not the only ones running that gearbox arrangement. Aston Martin have it as well. So it's not the only reason that they're having issues. Otherwise, we'd see it also on the green machine.
All right. Well, I was going to talk about McLaren a little bit, but we can talk about Aston if you'd like to first. They strike me as... If I was a fan of Aston, I would couch it as they're doing about exactly what I expected them to do. So from a design point of view, from a performance point of view, how accurate is that assessment? Are they bringing interesting, different, and unique? Can you see them? They talk all the time. They're pushing, you know, this, that, the other. Are they bringing something in the way that we've seen, you know, sort of Ferrari step up, or we saw McLaren last season step up? Have you seen that? And obviously they had extra ground to cover because they had issues last season after the updated technical directive.
Yeah, I mean, the way I see Aston is that they're consolidating the position that they currently sit within. They had a new front wing in Australia, which was more or less a brought forward from the package that arrived in Suzuka, which included new side pod bodywork, a new floor and a new diffuser, and yeah, that's about it. So the changes, though, that they've made in that respect bring them more in line with other designs that we've seen up and down the grid, and in fact is a reversion in some respect to a design that they had last season, in as much as that alongside the side pod, they've added a swage line, which helps to manage the flow between the flank itself and the upper surface. They abandoned that when they introduced those really deep gullies last season, but they've sort of amalgamated those two designs together. And all last season, they were one of the teams to run with a edge wing that ran under the side of under the floor to a rear cutout. But they've moved to what everybody else is sort of doing now with a tapered rear design. So for me, it's more like they're trying to move into an area of design whereby they're sort of falling in line with the other teams in and around them, rather than sort of having their own routes that they've taken. And I think that we'll see them become more exploratory again now that they've fallen in line. But we're going to have to wait a little while, because these sort of larger scale updates do take a long while to come through the pack. So it might be middle of the season again before we see something as substantial as we've already seen here in Japan.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so the other team then that this brings us to, very much so, is McLaren, I think. And in a sense, they have become the third team ahead of Mercedes. So question one would be one of circuit specificity. We seem to have been at a lot of circuits that had a lot of characteristics that we saw favoring McLaren at the end of last season. We know they capped their overall concept. And we also know that, once again, they failed to show up with the full car they had planned to. Now, they're not the only team that had production issues. But in terms of looking at their early season performance, is it just they got four birdies right off the bat, and now they're going to have to settle down and take some pars and bogeys, to use a golf analogy? I don't know why I'd pick a golf analogy. Or is it going to be one of those things where they're going to be able to persist because fundamentally they understand their car a bit better than the people they're competing with right now, which is, I would guess, mainly Mercedes and perhaps on occasion Aston.
Yeah, and you could also pull them into Ferrari territory on occasions if Ferrari themselves, but they haven't been doing that so far this season. I think McLaren have done very similarly to what they did last season, in as much as that they bought what they consider to be a baseline car, something that they feel like they understand and can extract performance from on a week-to-week basis, with minor modifications coming race by race in order to maybe bring small amounts of improvements. And then we'll see a much larger package of updates arrive in and around the start of the European season. But again, I think it's important to remember that McLaren were one of the first adopters of the underbite solution that Red Bull took on. And although it was something of a variant of their own, this season they don't have that, because I feel like they did exactly like Red Bull, in as much as that they found the ceiling of that solution and decided that they must adapt something different in order to find more performance going forward. So they've sort of gone in a different route to Red Bull, let's say, but it does have some tendencies towards what you see from the Red Bull, just not as large an undercut. So there is obviously potential there, but again, are we going to see them head in the Red Bull direction, or are they going to favour something that they've got under their sleeve for themselves? It'll be interesting to see where they sort of shake out when we see that first round of updates.
Yeah, well, this has been, you know, one of our favorite discussions on the show is where McLaren sits versus Mercedes versus Ferrari. And it's a little disappointing to me that they didn't have their full car sorted out for the beginning of the season. But I look at their performance and I'm like, well, their relative performance, it seems like they're sort of consolidating where they got to at the end of last season. And they still have scope, potential to stay there throughout the rest of the season.
Yeah, and it also comes down to working out your schedule in terms of how you use your simulation tools. So obviously, McLaren had to spend a huge amount of resource pooling towards the updates that had throughout the course of 2023, which then has an impact on the development schedule of the 2024 car. So it's almost like trying to rob Peter to pay Paul. You've taken some of your 2024 potential to improve your 2023 car. It's almost the reversal of what many teams would do. You know, most teams will take away some of the potential of their car heading into the back end of the season to improve the car for next season, whereas McLaren sort of did it a little bit backwards. And that is interesting in some ways because it goes against the generalised rule of how you would approach development. But it seemed to work for McLaren last season because of how they improved throughout the course of the season. And hopefully it will do similarly to them this season with an eye on perhaps being able to mirror the gap a little bit better heading into next season.
You mentioned that, and immediately I think, oh, it's almost like when a team does a really long overcut and then it actually works out and you're like all surprised and stuff like that. It's unusual, but it's working for them. And unlike the last season, I guess I would say the good news for McLaren is they started out with a baseline car that was much, much more capable than what they had at the beginning of last season.
Yeah, precisely that, because they finished off last season very well. So they've sort of used an extreme tactic, like you mentioned, you would do with an overcut or an undercut. And theirs has been an extremely long stint on a set of hard tyres, for argument's sake, as opposed to having a splash and dash on a set of softs.
Okay. I want to bring up what I consider to be a ray of hope, a small, tiny goodness. I mean, because we were very negative about Mercedes, not because we're negative about them, but just because the situation they find themselves in is a very negative one, especially if you're a fan of the team. But one team that has really impressed me and surprised me more than almost any other, to be honest, is Haas. And I don't know if you feel the same way about it, but they had been so nowhere last season. They seem to not have a lot of scope for new concept. And they, you know, were committed to not spending more money. They don't have a lot of sponsors, but they did change the leadership at the team. And I will say, I've been quite impressed by what they've been able to pull off. And by they seem to have stated that they're changing how they're planning to develop things. Not one giant development halfway through the season, but bits and bobs here and there. And so I'm going to ask you, from that point of view, how is it working out for them? And do you see some of the similar thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the situation at Haas, it's very, very different from how you look at what McLaren did last season, because they bought an update, I'm talking about Haas now, at the end of last season to sort of make them fall in line with everybody else in terms of what they were doing with their side pods. And they really didn't quite understand what was going on. And in fact, they often ran, you know, a dual program with one driver on one aerodynamic setup and another driver on another aerodynamic setup in order to try to figure out what was actually working best and how can we make improvements to what we've spent all this money on and make it work going into next season? Because we have to make a commitment as to whether we're sticking with what we had or whether there's actually potential in this new design that we've, you know, spent resource and money on. And eventually that did win out. This year's car is very much an evolution of the back end of last season's updates. So there was more ceiling for performance available in that design. And obviously they've managed to unlock that by understanding fundamentally how those aerodynamic surfaces work, how they interact with everything else on the car. And this car is just a step on from what we saw last season. And as you say, they are finding the performance level that you would expect them to have and not being sat down the back of the pack.
And I think if we're going to be talking about teams like that, perhaps the other team we should mention at this point is the former Toro Rosso, a.k.a. Visa, Cash App, RB, et cetera, and so on. And what I wonder about them is they have always promised in the past all this performance and absolutely not delivered it. But at least in the hands of Yuki, it seems like there has been a significant step forward, or at least a return to the level that you'd expect to see from a team that used to be the RB, that used to be the RB Red Bull, the Red Bull Junior team.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because we're used to seeing this team under a different guise. So we've suddenly got them as a completely different name appearing on the side of the car, etc. But, you know, they're fundamentally the same team as we've had in the past. They've done a huge amount of work on this car compared to last season, and they've brought a huge amount of updates over the course of the opening few races as well, which is interesting in as much as that in the opening few races of a season, we don't tend to find too much going on in terms of this level of changes to the floor, the side pods, you know, the big structures. They tend to come later in the season when we get into the European season, but for whatever reason, RB, VCarb, whatever you want to call them, started out with a fairly decent baseline, but already had the intention of bringing a large collection of parts to those opening few races. So again, we're finding a team that are trying to do something completely different and have managed to find lap time, or certainly on one side of the garage, that has enabled them to score well through those first few races. But at what cost? Where does that then lead them as the pack sort of adjusts itself, as the other teams bring updates that they won't be able to infill because they've made bigger strides earlier on?
Right. Well, it's the classic development undercut versus the classic development overcut then. But it is heartening to see them at least performing, you know, even if it's just for the first six or eight races till the other team's developments start launching them forward. It's heartening to see them at least getting back to that level and being in that position of just trying to hang on throughout the season. And I had wanted to save some time because your esteemed colleague has done some interesting reporting on the upcoming set of regulations. But I briefly do want to mention two teams that are having some struggles now for, I assume, somewhat different reasons. And I think we should probably start with Williams, because they well overperformed themselves last season. But for all of the honor and glory that they gained doing so, fundamentally, a lot of that credit went to James Vowles, when the reality is that was really Jost Capito's last car. And this is the first season we're seeing a car with Vowles being in charge at Williams. And they seem to be having some issues, especially with production, that that are, I don't know, vaguely worrisome. Is that a good phrase?
Yeah, you mean like the fact that they haven't got a chassis ready or a spare chassis ready? I mean, it's not as bad as under that year when Paddy Lowe and the team turned up at Barcelona without a car and they had to run the previous year's car. So this isn't new for Williams, let's add. This is a hangover of years upon years of infrastructure difficulties that the team have been undergoing and have to adapt to in order to maximise their performance going forward. I mean, I've seen interviews with Vels where he's basically saying that they're running spreadsheets upon spreadsheets upon spreadsheets because that's how they've worked for a very long time, whereas there's more effective ways of managing those situations within other teams. You know, Vels has got a world or a wealth of experience with Mercedes, and that is the primary driver why we would expect them to be improving their performance envelope, because he's come on board and he's enacting change. Now, he's not the first to try this. Paddy Lowe tried it in the past. Capito tried it in the past. And now we've got James Vowles at the head of the helm trying to do a very similar thing. But it appears that he's having more of a inroad on those aspects. However, it's a long road. You know, you can't make change overnight to infrastructure problems that you have. I remember a conversation that was had with him whereby there's a piece of machinery that he knows is the sort of a briefcase size at Mercedes that took up a whole room at Williams. You know, so if they're working with machinery that is what you would consider to be old in F1 terms, then that is going to have an impact on how you develop components moving forward. It's going to have an impact on how you design components. And it just feels to me as if Williams have got to a point whereby, because they haven't been able to spend money in the sport in the way that they wanted to in the past, they've fallen well behind their peers. And now they're having to come up with ways in which to bridge that gap. And there's going to be shortfalls on occasions, i.e. parts being late to races or not having a spare chassis, as we found out when that crash occurred in Australia.
Right. And so I wanted to ask you about this because production is one of those areas where we know they're far behind, and we know that there are much better solutions out there, ANSYS for Red Bull, for example, that can really speed up and make everybody's life much easier. And yet it seems like a fair amount of resource was spent on the Williams trying to make it more predictable and to solve some of the fundamental issues that I know Albon was referencing last year. That said, last year's car was problematic to drive, but it was competitive on occasion on the right kind of track. And Albon could drive it without crashing it. And we've had both drivers have fairly major crashes. I mean, yes, I know, Sergeant, you could say was brain fade, not necessarily the car, but the car itself doesn't seem a lot more predictable. It lacks some of the strengths that it had last season. And you still have sort of these production issues that haven't been solved. So why hasn't Williams started, say, a technology company that builds things out of carbon fiber? And much like Haas outsources to Dallara, they just outsource the building, and that way all that money is outside of their cost cap. Do you think that Vowles has maybe tried to do too much simultaneously and might have been better off just picking one area to be really a lot better in here? That's a long way to ask a simple question, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's failure points along the way, isn't there, whereby you're not going to get the desired result from having to give up some of the resource aspect of making changes. It's how you deliver those changes. And yes, you're right. I don't believe this car is relatively better than last year's car because it has had to sacrifice what made it good. Very much, I find this year's car is the second album that is very difficult to achieve, in as much as if you look at the difference between the 2014 Williams and the 2015 Williams. Now, the 2014 Williams was what I would call a slipstreamer, where it was basically a low drag car that was good, you know, in a straight line, but couldn't really be very good anywhere else. And it had the advantage of the Mercedes power unit at that time as well, which obviously gave it a massive edge. Now, the 2015 car was a very different animal because they tried to pile on downforce and they just couldn't achieve it. It was very, very different in its approach. And I feel that the same sort of design aspect can be seen in last year's Williams and this year's Williams. If you look at how good that the Williams of last year was in a straight line, it was its best aspect by a long stretch. Yet this year they don't have that advantage. Now that's partly because the other teams have obviously found ways to mitigate that difference, but also because Williams have tried to change the way in which that their car operates over a wider envelope. And so they've lost their best aspect to try to gain elsewhere. And unfortunately, it just doesn't tie up. And they find themselves a little bit adrift of where they were. And they find themselves in a situation where their drivers don't feel or find fundamentally the same level of comfortability that they had last season.
Okay. And I'm just going to move us forward a little bit because we're sort of at the end of the grid here. But I want to mention Sauber real quick because they look good, but then they have no results. Now, last season, I very much felt like they were loafing, and I think you sort of confirmed that. But this season, have they brought something to the table and we're just not seeing it because their wheel nuts cross thread? Or is it, are they still kind of in that holding pattern because we know that Audi is coming in?
Yeah, I think they're kind of in a bit of a holding pattern, aren't they? Sauber are a difficult one because they sort of fluctuate depending on where they sit within the championship standings and how much simulation work that they can undertake. So in the first year of the regulations, we saw them make some pretty substantial gains in between the points of when the regulation reset happens midway through a season. And I feel that that perhaps has a distinct pattern on how they develop, because it just comes at the wrong time for them in terms of when they're actually finding performance, and then suddenly it drops off, and so on and so forth. So it's sort of they sort of ride a crest of a wave in terms of development, and then sort of peter out a little bit. But I think that's more to do with the regulation cycle for simulation. And I do feel that might need to be readdressed, the cost cap and the CFD wind tunnel aspect of the regulations when we get to 2026, to try to help out those smaller teams in comparison to the bigger teams, just purely because of resource.
Right. So what I want to ask then, since we're talking about the last team, is are we going to see sort of an upsurge as they get on top of these technical problems? Or do you think fundamentally they're just behind?
I think a bit of both. I think we will see them improve because operationally they're away from where they need to be right now. Every time they make a pit stop, they're worried about the fact that they're going to cross thread a wheel nut and have a longer pit stop than Mercedes did in 20 whatever it was when Valtteri Bottas spent 3 days in a pit stop. And I also think that they will improve this car once the season starts to unfold. It's very early in the season for them to find masses of performance because they haven't bought masses of updates. So they're still working realistically with what they bring to the pre-season test, aside from a few bits here and there. And they'll have tried to figure out data-wise what they need to do to optimise the car going forward, and we should start to see those updates filter through over the course of the next few races.
All right, then, since we're done with talking about all the teams on the grid, nothing? No other teams to talk about?
There is another team.
We can move on?
I didn't want to bring them up.
Okay, fine. But I think we do need to talk about... I saw statistics. I'm not going to go for exactly how true it is that this season Gasly has yet to overtake a single car and that Ocon is the most overtaken driver on the grid. And I would just argue that, whatever you think of either driver, neither of them deserves to be in that position. So can you just explain to me what has gone so very, very wrong at Alpine? Because I'm just looking at it and I'm just shaking my head. Like, I don't know what's happened to them, but it just, what a fall.
Well, if we look at this year's car, it's not highly developed in comparison to where you would expect it to be in many areas compared to last season. They haven't made the level of change that would dictate them making some vault up the grid. And obviously we already understand that they feel that they're dramatically behind the rest of the teams when it comes to the power unit and how much more cooling that they have to run on the car, how much that has an impact on them in terms of their strategy, in terms of how it impacts on aerodynamics, which they've tried to mitigate in the past by some very clever solutions in and around the airbox and side pods, etc. But this car just seems very, very vanilla in comparison to what we've seen from them in the past. They've tended to lead in many ways in the past in terms of aerodynamic developments that we've then seen appear on other cars, and we can't say that for this car in any way. So fundamentally, I think they're adrift of everybody else, and they know they're adrift of everybody else, and they're preparing themselves for the next set of regulations, effectively, and hoping, as always, that they pin their hopes on something in the future rather than the present.
Oh, it's a sad, sad sight to see, I will admit. But I hope they can come to some improvement over the course of this season, because it's a shame to have two talented drivers and many talented engineers, too. As you point out, like, a lot of what they had brought to the table in the last season or two has shown up across the board on all the teams. They've been very creative, I guess, even if they haven't been able to get themselves up into the vaunted, you know, top three or top four. But this is just, it's just got to be brutal time to be a team right now.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that you have to look at the managerial restructuring that constantly occurs at Alpine or Renault or Lotus or whoever they've been in the past. It seems like a Rolodex of names come and go and then find positions at other teams. It's almost like a Premier League football team. Let's sack the wrong person at the right time to try to get better results. And, you know, we've seen people depart at the start of this season, for argument's sake, Matt Harmon, technical director, and so on and so forth. And that has a destabilizing factor to the entirety of the structure of the team. You know, it's not just, and I understand it's just one person in a huge production of people that work in and around that factory. But we're talking about key personnel here who help to get the best from others. And when they are changing constantly, then you're always in a state of flux. And obviously that isn't good from an organisational point of view. And unfortunately, it appears that this team have been in that flux for a long period of time now.
Okay, speaking of flux, I promised that we would talk about this a little bit because I'm so intrigued by it. But your colleague broke a little story today about the upcoming regulation set. And basically, if I can paraphrase, when they looked at what they were planning to do with what they call active aerodynamics, which is different to what we understood it to be back in 94 with the Williams, which was really ride height control. This is actual active aerodynamics, wings going up and down and all sorts of flappy bits. When they tried it in the sim, they found that the car was the word undrivable mentioned, spinning at full throttle on a straight. I think you put up a video of the classic Marcus Ericsson. So explain to me what the problem is with these new regulations. Is it a fixable problem, do you think? And are we suddenly looking at, because I thought they were supposed to be finalizing them pretty soon. This is for the 26 regulations, by the way. Are we looking at, well, maybe we're just going to wait another year before we start with this and just stick to the power unit, which frankly seems like it makes more sense to me.
Yeah, well, I think there's a several things unfolding here. I think the majority of what's being mentioned is doom-mongering. And we tend to get that in Formula One when there's a huge amount of change and teams want to push back against that change because they don't like particularly how it looks for them at that given moment. Now, I think it's crucial to say that there is always a stream of models that the FIA present to the teams, and they're at different stages as to where those models are going to appear at each stage at each team in order that, you know, we get different results. So the model that that's been talked about might not be the model that X or Y team has versus the X or Y team that has come out with the statements that they have. Now, also, let's have a talk about what we're talking about with Active Aero. Active Aero, from what I understand from this new regulation set, will be more predominantly to do with the rear wing in terms of we'll have a four-tier rear wing rather than a two-tier wing that we've got now, which means that you can have more maneuverability in the flapped sections of the wings in order that you can reduce more drag, but you can also have more downforce. And so obviously that means that the magnitude at which the downforce is removed from the car suddenly is exponentially larger than what we currently have with DRS, which means, as you mentioned, that suddenly when the rear wing opens, we've got the rear wheel spinning up because we've got too much torque to override what's going on with the wing. Now, those are things that can be overcome, that can be redesigned, because we're dealing with a low-scale model that is in the early phases of being understood. But it also then does raise questions. Well, if we're doing that with the rear wing, surely the balance on the car is going to be extremely difficult from front to rear. And we've seen that before with DRS when it was first introduced. That also has a problem with the tyre components, because we've seen this in the past whereby we've had problems with tyre heating issues because of front to rear balance issues. So now there is talk perhaps of having an adjustable front wing element as well involved in these regulations. And so I think it's just at this stage a back and forth between the teams and the FIA to try to understand how to better develop this set of regulations in a way that will work to achieve the efficiency levels that are required to pair with the power unit change as well. Because obviously it's not just aerodynamic changes we've got here. We've got a huge amount of changes coming on the power unit, which is an entirely new power unit that's going to be used for 26 onwards. So there's a huge amount to change. And I think the teams will work with the FIA now to try to find a solution that will work best moving into that season. If indeed, as you say, it happens in 26, because there's precedent there that means we might move back a year.
Right. So essentially what you're saying is this is just normal problem solving that happens every time you make this big of a change, because this is a pretty big change from what we've had in the past. I will grant you that. And does any of this come from, like, I know the ground effect regulations, not everybody was super happy with them, but fundamentally that was funded by FOM, by Formula One, not by the FIA. This regulation set is less that, do you know? I'm not sure myself, but at least the previous ones kind of sort of worked mainly until they changed them the second year, the way that they were intended to work. And I'm wondering, can we expect a similar thing out of this upcoming set of regulations based on what you're seeing now?
Yeah, I mean, the working groups that are involved in this situation will still have some of the FOM involvement. It won't just be the FIA coming up with a set of regulations, because they don't have the workforce to be able to enact that side of things. So there will be some involvement from FOM. There's obviously involvement from the teams, which I always find to be a dangerous scenario, because you're allowing a competitor to frame a set of regulations to suit a set of criteria that they are then going to follow. But anyway, I digress. I think it's important to remember that the regulations for 2009 were supposed to be introduced in 2008. The regulations for 2014 were supposed to be introduced in 2013. And the regulations for 2022 were supposed to be introduced in 2021. So we've got a precedent here of pushing regulations back in order to facilitate a better set of regulations moving forward. However, using the word better might be a bit of a distraction, actually, because I still don't firmly believe that this set of regulations have been successful at all. I also said at the start of these regulations on Missed Apex that I believed that there were certain reasons why they wouldn't be as successful as that was first thought out. And those things have come to pass. We've already got wake issues. Some of the reasons why racing wheel-to-wheel isn't as good as it has been over the course of the last few years is because of the field spread. And until we sort those problems out, any regulation set that you try to muster up is going to be problematic. So, yes, we're starting from scratch, but are we starting from scratch in a way in which that the teams are going to then overcome very quickly? Or are we starting from scratch in a way in which that it's problematic for them and they have to find more solutions along the way? And until we're there, we won't really know the answer to that.
Well, on that Cassandra Lake warning, I think we have reached the end of our show. So tell us before you go, where can we find you? Where should we look for your work?
Okay, so the usual places, really, Twitter or X as it's now known. I still got the Twitter app on my phone, believe it or not. It's not X on my phone, Mr. Elon Musk. So there I obviously post regularly, and you can find my work over on motorsport.com and autosport.co.uk.
And be sure and check it out. It's absolutely worth it. As for me, I'm at MattPT55 on the Twitters or any other social network where you'd care to look for me. And remember, until next time, this has been Missed Apex Podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.